The High Museum of Art has been lauded for their many special exhibitions, but their ever-growing permanent collection holds many priceless and important works of art, not least of all in their collection of folk art. The High began collecting these works in the 1970s, and in fact, they're the first general museum in North America to have, beginning in 1994, a full-time curator devoted to folk art and self-taught art. In late January, the High Museum announced a new hire to that position. Her name is Catherine Gentleson, and she is currently a PhD candidate at Duke University and begins at the High this fall. She was in town recently and sat down with us in our studios to talk about the position and the work that will be bringing her to Atlanta. Katie Gentleson, you are the incoming curator of folk art at the High Museum. One thing I've noticed about folks who work at the High is that they often have really long and impressive sounding titles for their jobs. Do you know what yours is going to be?
It's the Marion Dan Boone Curator of Folk and Self-Taught Art.
That is impressive. So, here in Georgia, I think that most people identify the term folk art with the artist Howard Finster, he of Paradis Gardens right outside of Athens. And there's quite a bit of his work in the High's permanent collection, but what are we talking about when we use the term folk art?
Well, folk art is a pretty broad category. I mean, it goes all the way back to the colonial period, really. So it's historical objects, many of which were made for utilitarian purposes, like quilts and weather vanes and that sort of thing. Moving up all the way into the present century with contemporary artists who are self-taught, which is why we often call them self-taught artists instead of folk artists, but were never part of any kind of academic school. So that's why we don't just call them artists. And so it's this really, really broad field, and it has a lot of kind of subdivisions within it. But you can kind of get the idea. I think the term still works to kind of signal that this is non-academic art we're talking about. It's not art coming out of an art school.
Yeah. Can you give us a few examples of folk artists throughout history?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so going back in time, I guess some of the really interesting to me folk artists of the 19th century are African Americans who created face jugs. So that's a really important American folk art tradition that, again, there was a kind of school around this, and that there were potters not working in total isolation but learning from each other. But it was a really kind of non-traditional art form in the 19th century. It wasn't what you would find at the National Academy or, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts or that sort of thing.
Yeah, and again, these would be, like you said, utilitarian objects. These are jugs that people actually put, like, water or liquor in or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. And so there's a lot of anonymous folk artists who partook of traditions like that in the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, what you get is attention for the first time to named artists, to individuals who, are either recently deceased or are still alive, but are being identified as kind of persisting this kind of American originality that we associate with folk art. The person that I start my dissertation with is John Cain, who is a Pittsburgh former coal miner and steel worker and, railroad builder. He basically did everything that you could do at the turn of the century if you were a laborer living in that part of the country. And then he ended up losing his leg in an accident. And he'd always been interested in creating art, but had just kind of made sketches and done small things that in his spare time. But he started house painting as a result of his injury. He could no longer do the kind of manual labor that he was doing before, so he switched to house painting, and from there he realized he wanted to paint canvases. And he had his first breakthrough in an art world context at the Carnegie International in 1927. And he was really the first kind of self-taught American artist of the 20th century to get major recognition to, you know, crash the gates of the art world and kind of open that path for many generations of artists to come. With John Cane, what you get is this highly individualized and really iconic personality. He becomes like a huge hit with the Pittsburgh Press. It's, you know, a real sensation in the media when this house painter gets his painting into one of the biggest exhibitions to happen around the world every year. He marks the beginning of that kind of recognition of an individual who's self-taught and who's creating what the art world sees to be very important art.
And we've seen so many more of these throughout since 1927.
Yes.
Howard Finster being one of them. And
yeah,
I keep returning
exactly.
to him because he's a recognizable name to probably many of our listeners. Can you kind of tell me about like where he falls in the spectrum, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm interested in is how in the 20th century, there's kind of these great waves of interest in self-taught artists that begin with 1927. And Howard Finster comes in this maybe third great wave of interest in self-taught artists that happens in the bicentennial moment. So it's a really kind of 1970s moment of being reconnecting with American traditions like quilt making, like wood carving. And there are a lot of things going on like the Smithsonian National Folklife Festival that are happening for the first time. And Finster is part of this kind of craze for all things Americana that gets really a lot of play in that era. And then what's unique about Finster and why he kind of has become such a larger-than-life figure is that he goes on for, even when that's worn off, you know, when the kind of bicentennial fervor is over, he attracts all these new constituencies, like the counterculture movements of the 80s and 90s. You know, bands are loving him, his work's appearing on album covers for Talking Heads, and REM is, you know, in Athens and becomes interested in his work as well. And so he's such a successful personality and just such an amazing artist that he appeals to all these different constituencies, you know, in the art world and beyond.
So he kind of became the rock star of the movement.
Totally. And he really milked it. I mean, had such a great personality and he loved the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was really looking to spread the word of God. And so he would take any kind of platform that he was given, whether it was, you know, discarded pieces of wood that he would turn into amazing artworks, or, you know, the Johnny Carson show.
Yeah. Calendars and clocks no more. I wore a collar and tie so long for 45 years. I pastored churches and preached funerals and married people to finally, when I got out of a collar and tie, I think to myself, I don't want to never put another on. You know?
You put it on tonight, though.
Well, yeah, this is a pretty big place here.
So it was really the kind of this perfect storm of an individual who wanted a platform, who wanted to be heard, and a, you know, cultural moment where people were taking an interest again in this kind of idea of American creativity that was, you know, completely untutored.
So you've been studying folk art for years now. You've written about it. You're working on your dissertation on it now, correct?
Yeah.
So can you tell me about where your work began, where the fascination came from?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'd love to. So for me, I studied art in college, and I was more interested in European painting. American interest had just kind of, I mean, American art had just never really caught my interest in any of the classes that I took. And then I had this crazy moment around 2006, between 2006 and 2009, where I was living in New York and I was working as a journalist, covering the art world and the art market, so going to a lot of shows. And I kept ending up face to face with this phenomenon of folk and self-taught art that I didn't know existed, because I certainly hadn't learned about it in my art history classes. And I went to this one amazing show at a gallery in New York called Galerie Saint-Étienne, where they were restaging a historical show that had happened in 1943 called They Taught Themselves. And this was a group show that was featured a lot of now iconic self-taught artists like that John Cain, who I mentioned earlier, and Grandma Moses. And I was fascinated by the fact that the show happened in a moment, especially kind of 1940s is when kind of abstract expressionism is starting to gain momentum and this sort of thing. And I wanted to know more about how this fit in. You know, who were these artists? What was their story? Why aren't they in the art history books? Why aren't they in American museums? And of course they are. And once I started looking for them, I found them. But I just got really excited about the possibility of doing more work and learning more about how they kind of fit into this greater picture of American art. There's a lot of really amazing work that's been done, but a lot of the time with folk and self-taught art, it's studied as kind of this marginalized phenomenon, you know, as something that exists really separate from what's going on in the rest of the art world or in the rest of America more broadly. And what's exciting is that we're living in a moment where that's changing. So folk and self-taught artists are being put into larger contexts the same way that you do with other artists who are trained. You know, you don't look at an artist like Picasso in isolation from everything that was going on, you know, at the turn of the century up through, you know, the end of his amazing career. You look at him in the period in which he lived and try to understand the forces that he was reacting to when he was creating his art. And that's increasingly being done with self-taught artists, which is really great. So it's, you know, there's more thinking about them in social contexts like the Great Migration, and also in relation to the larger trends of American art that are happening at the times that they get recognized. And to me, that's what's so interesting. It's like, what is it about these people in this moment that makes them so meaningful, you know, that makes their artwork so important? And I feel really committed to bringing that out in my work at the High.
So you've been working out of the Smithsonian Museum of American Art, correct? Working on your dissertation?
Yeah, I'm a fellow at the Smithsonian American Art Museum now.
So you've been around, you've seen a lot of collections in your research. How does the High stack up?
The High has an incredible collection because it really started, you know, before other museums were collecting self-taught art. I mean, museums first started bringing the work of folk artists and self-taught artists into their collections in the 20s and 30s. But there was kind of a drop-off in the post-war period. And then again, this kind of bicentennial moment happens and people start becoming interested again. And the High was very much a part of that. But what they did that other museums didn't do is they began a collection then in the 1970s that they've consistently built, you know, in the 80s, in the 90s, up to the present moment. And so that's why they have such an incredible collection, is they've really been committed to this genre of art for, you know, going on 50 years. And their collection reflects these amazing shifts that have happened in the field. So, you know, the first works that they acquired are by people like Mattie Lou O'Kelly, who was a, you know, figurative painter. She painted beautiful still lives and farm scenes. She's a kind of associated with this certain one-eyed paradigm of the American folk artist, which is, you know, she's a white Southern woman. And then now the High's collection really reflects a full diversity of self-taught artists. So there's, you know, you have great African-American self-taught artists like Ronald Lockett and Thornton Dial. And you see this kind of diversification of the field right there in the Heis collection.
Yeah. You begin your work at the High in September, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And so what are you looking forward to doing once you're here?
Well, I'm really excited to get to know the community. I mean, there's just obviously with decades of support of this art, there's already established such a strong network of people who think it's important, who have amazing collections, who have amazing stories, you know, of meeting people like Finster. And I can't wait to really get to know all those folks. And then I'm thrilled to get to know the collection better. I'm, you know, starting now, but there's more than 800 works and, you know, countless papers and interesting archives.
Tell me about that. So there's it's in the Heis collection, it's not just the art itself, but there's all this extraneous material that came with it.
You know, museums typically when they make acquisitions, when they have holdings, many holdings of a specific artist, like in the Heis case, the collection is very rich with holdings of works by Nellie Mae Rowe and Howard Finster. You know, in acquiring all of those works, they often get an amazing cache of archival material that have to do with the works, you know, that have to do with the collector and the artists and their correspondence, that are, you know, historical kind of interpretations of the works and artifacts that really open new doors to our understanding of what the artist was trying to do with X, Y, and Z work. And so it's really exciting to be kind of, you know, just at the beginning of coming to understand what the High has, all of these amazing papers that go along with their incredible collection.
Katie, it's been really great talking to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Yeah. It's been a really fun conversation.